Hello, I'm Badis, and welcome to the Implement Podcast. This is a podcast where we have great conversations about marketing, growing brands, and what it takes to be a great marketer. If you're interested in keeping up with the podcast episodes and the amazing content we produce at Implement, you should definitely subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to join-implement.com to subscribe. All right, enough self-promo, let's dive into this new episode, and thanks again for tuning in. Welcome everyone to this new episode of the Implement Podcast. Today, my guest is Amin Makani. Amin is SVP of Growth Strategy at Bento Box. Amin, thank you so much for joining me today and taking the time. And before we start, could you maybe introduce yourself a bit more to the audience?
Yeah, sure thing. I'm Amin Makani. I'm SVP of Growth Strategy at Bento Box, and I've been working for venture-backed startups for about 12 years, almost entirely in the growth marketing capacity, but I've dabbled in finance, a few years here or there, some operations work. So, you know, mostly go-to-market, but a little bit of G&A. And then, I'm at Bento Box right now. I had a long stint at a company called Yext, which is a New York-based startup that went public in 2017. And then I also spent a little bit of time at JW Player, which is video tech. So all kind of SaaS, but different flavors of SaaS.
Awesome. Yeah, it's. I'm curious to know, you know, about a little bit more about Bento Box. And so what is Bento Box about, really?
Yeah, Bento Box is a restaurant hospitality software. It helps restaurants connect with their diners online. I think that hospitality for restaurateurs for a long time was not online, and they kind of viewed online as detraction from hospitality because hospitality was supposed to be like in person and you give them something. But now there's this like larger extension where people are researching a restaurant online before they come. And that was even before the pandemic, people would order online, but now specifically in the post-pandemic is that so much of your experience for your diners can be off-premise. So hospitality has to leave the walls more so than ever before. And Bento Box provides that those tools to the restaurants to allow to have tools to extend hospitality beyond the walls of your restaurant.
Yeah.
And web tools. And that's what Bento Box provides.
That's awesome. So did you guys actually sort of, was it more of an opportunity this pandemic or more of a, you know?
I think what I'd like to say is that like, what's a company that did poorly? We're not like Hertz Car Rental. Or AMC movie theaters, but we're not Zoom either. So like we had some really great tailwinds that allowed us to pick up a lot of customers, but we also had some tailwinds in that a lot of restaurants went out of business. It was a hard time for restaurants in this last year. And so I don't want to take anything for granted that like, oh, this was a great time for us, because it was not a great time for a lot of restaurants. And we felt that as well. But I think that our core value prop and our mission became more deeply ingrained with the mission of the restaurant, which is like always good when you can help your customers more. And I think that we were providing more value for our customers, the ones that were able to stay in business, I think there was a lot too, that the kinds of customers that were able to pivot to off-premise and really thrive off-premise were doing better, I think. And the ones that had trouble making that switch had a hard time. And some of them still survived. I think there's also a little bit of like the haves and the have nots, where I think if you were a business that was thriving in your local area and you had a lot of loyal support from patrons, from diners, it was really good.
Yeah.
If you didn't, then it was a challenging time.
Yeah. I bet. I mean, it's a tough time everywhere. And actually, this solution Bento Box makes me think of a French company called Zen Chef, I think, which I've sort of like met their founder a while back, Yeah, it's an interesting business because it's you know, the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, as you said, has really yet to be digitalized in so many ways. And I remember one of the challenges of ZenChef was the acquisition, because it was very hard to sort of get their foot, you know, in the door and at a price that is reasonable, because you know, sending a sort of a sales rep, you know, to every restaurant in the neighborhood was, you know, gonna cost a lot in terms of, you know, just CAC, and so they had a lot of challenges there. And so could you tell us a bit more about, you know, selling to restaurants and marketing to restaurants? I know it's today, you know, with the pandemic, it's a different environment, but like, what are sort of the core principles? What are sort of the channels you guys use and the campaigns you have in place?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think it's hard for a lot of reasons. So I've been in small business marketing for a long time, different kinds of small business. At Yext, we did all the businesses, you know, and here we just have restaurants, right? And so I think when a target is too narrow, let's say like 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 in the whole universe, let's say that's the size of it, then like you try to acquire all the email addresses, build custom lists, but like your opportunity to do digital marketing is quite low, because the universe is too small, right? So you can do some search, high volume, high value, low volume search, paid search. You can do maybe some social, but probably not. Maybe you can make LinkedIn work, but probably not. But so we're just large enough at our base. I think, you know, from my estimates, there's 300,000 independent restaurants in the United States. There's like 650,000 restaurants total. I think probably less now, pandemic, but I think that's the steady state. It will get back to there, 650, let's say. And 350 are like chains, big chains, McDonald's, you know, it's location count. There's like, I think maybe like 100 brands make up like 350,000 or 300, between 300 and 350,000 locations, McDonald's, Subways, Domino's, whatever. So you have 650 total, about 350 of these mega chains, and the 300 remaining are the independents. But there might be like two or three decision makers, you know, maybe it's a mom and pop place, but then there's the mom and the pop, right? And then maybe some GM, right? Yeah. So, or maybe not, but, or you have a bigger group where it's like they own, you know, six or seven restaurant concepts, six, seven brands, and there's a marketing team, and there's an owner, and there's some general managers or whatever. So I think on the per restaurant, you might have two or three decision makers. So let's say that's kind of on the order of 1 million people. And so it's small, it's not microscopic, it's not 10,000, but it's small. So you have to be pretty targeted. And then there's another challenge, is that like people are searching for restaurants, and so, or people are searching for food, so it's easy for confusion to happen around people trying to search for food, trying to search to go to restaurants instead of searching for software for restaurants. So that's the thing, is if you start seeing stuff that's like too large, it means that if you start seeing things that are like in the millions of audience members, something's off. And so you have to be careful to like be scrutinized if it looks too good to be true, right? And then you end up with a lot of stuff that's like in the 50 30 40 50,000 range in terms of target audience, which is fine, but it's hard, right? So I think the challenge is like making sure the audiences are tight, and like not trying to, what I call like chase big audiences, because it'll solve your small audience problem, because the audience is probably wrong. And so like, even if you see 1 million folks, the chances that they can target 1 million, the whole million, that is the all three people at all 300,000 restaurants perfectly, and they can perfectly do it, is just so unlikely. So it's likely a lot of foodies, people interested in food. So be real careful there. I think that's like the thing is, but it's just large enough where like digital media can be possible, which is nice, which at least is nice. You know, sometimes when the audience gets too narrow, you can't even do it at all. So here we can do it, but we got to be real disciplined with the audiences.
Thanks for sharing this. I'm curious to know, like, do you guys use any, I mean, or did you use any physical type of marketing at all?
We do some, we do direct mail of different form factors. We've done postcards, we do letters, we've done like a little gift boxes for people who are a little larger scale. So we've kind of dabbled in a ton of different things. And it's and we're figuring out kind of like what's the thing. I think there is something where I'm a big believer is that you're not going to get pure attribution on everything, but like if you have, if you know you're hitting the right people, if you know you're targeting, if your audience is tight, then you can put up with a little bit lower ROI because you know you were making progress towards like convincing that person you might see that ROI in other channels. But the problem I think some marketers do is they use that justification, but they don't make sure the audience is tight. So then they're nurturing a bunch of people who are like not their audience, who are just like random people. Yeah. So then they're like, no, it's going to work because it's awareness, but it's awareness to the wrong people. So it doesn't work. So there is that, that's like a you know, you don't get this. I maybe this is from my little bit of time in the finance section, but finance department. But I'm like more like, are you really reaching the right people or not? Like, I'm not trying to be like, hey, you have to show me, like, because attribution's hard, right? It's not perfect. There's a lot of online, offline. There's people that have multiple touch points that come, and there's a lot of fancy stuff that say they can do all these things, but they can't. You know, nobody can combine the display on your phone with the search you did on your computer plus the direct mail you got to like your home rather than your office. There's like, so you have to just, if you, you have to make sure that you have to sample the audience correctly and make sure that this is the right audience. And if it is, and the audience is smallish, then if you're hitting the same, you know, audience over and over again, you're going to get progress. You're going to make gains on this.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked about being in the finance industry, and then you talked about, you're mentioning Yext, right? Your previous company.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about that. Like you've been the first hire in the marketing department there, and it grew like to a public company now. Like, you know, how did it go? Like, tell me about that story.
Yeah, man, it was kind of in us classic crazy story. I think that, well, so this is what I'll say, and maybe this is, I'm being too, I don't know the right word, but it started when I started, it was 2008, you know, height of the recession. I started there, you know, the depths of recession rather than the heights. And I was sitting in this room with the CEO when I interviewed. I was like right out of college, and I sat in this room with the CEO, and I was like, this is going to be a $1 billion company one day. And in my mind, I was like, okay, cool, man, let's do it. And it was small. It was like a company that was like, I think the last valuation was like 25 million or 20 million. So it was like a small company. Right. And we were able to grow up to a $1 billion company. And I think that it didn't come in a straight line, right? There was like downs and ups and you get there eventually, and it's pretty wonderful. But the real thing now is that like people open the gates at $1 billion these days. Like Clubhouse, their first round was $1 billion, and I think that, you know, you see these like pre-revenue SaaS companies raising at $40-50 million valuations, and raising, you know, companies doing like 50-60 million of run rate raising at $3 billion valuation. It's I think that the experience I had is more quaint almost than impressive at this point, because people are doing so much crazy stuff. But back in 08, a $1 billion company meant a lot. You know, the term unicorn wasn't even coined at the time. So what I think now is that there's a lot more resources available. Like even just like for marketing, you had to build everything yourself. You had to manage everything yourself. But now there's like so many marketing tools that can like, I mean, some of them don't do that much, but like there's like so many, you know, it's on you to figure out the right thing, and there's access to capital and valuations are richer. And like, you just have a better fighting chance at building a $1 billion business, building a multi-$1 billion business, and even building, you know, successful. A lot of people criticize the tech industry for these bloated valuations, and I think there's some fair criticism there. But also, if you look at some of these like mature SaaS companies, the free cash flow margins are good. Mm. And like there are a lot of them burn cash, and like you look and it's like not everybody gets some dizzying multiple. Like you look at my old company Yext, and like they're doing almost 400 million of revenue this year, and they trade at like kind of 2 billion. So they trade at 5X, and you look at Snowflake trades at 80X. And why does Snowflake, and they have very similar revenue, right? And so Snowflake trades at 80X. And why does Snowflake trade at 80X? Because there's future there. It's growing fast, it's growing over 100%. Yext is only growing at 10-15% now. So it's like going to trade at 5X. But I think, but you look at like even companies like, what's a good example? Zendesk. or HubSpot. You look at and the operating cash flow is good. Like there's like a lot of stock based compensation which drives down the profit margins, like from a GAAP standpoint, but a non GAAP on a cash basis, these are good businesses that like that are profitable, that generate a lot of cash, and they're still growing at 20-30% a year. Who knows where they can be? I think there's no real idea of like where these businesses stop. And so the multiples are probably rich, but they're not rich for everybody. Some of them are pretty affordable. It's just like the hot names around the road. I guess this is more finance talk, but I'm like kind of pessimistic in the near term. Just I think the multiples have grown too high, too fast, and you have a lot of headwinds in the next kind of 8 to 12 months with like interest rates going up. I think that there's been a lot of like kind of this like YOLO stock trading that is amplifying some of the multiples. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because people don't have anything else to spend their money on because stuff is mostly closed. But like once you can go on vacation and go to sports game and do sports gambling and and go to bars with your friends and like blow a bunch of money on a trip to Vegas, I think some of the demand for like hot tech stocks will go down. And so like from a supply and demand standpoint, the demand is down. So, and I think that we don't really know what the long-term growth rates will be of these companies, because some of it is like digital transformation that is a one-time move. Maybe like, no, but there's still so much left. And maybe there is, maybe another 10 years of it. But like, we don't have another 30 years of it. Like Amazon's been growing at this rate for 30 years. I don't think that you'll see a company like, something I love like Twilio. I think Twilio is a wonderful business. And I think they've been growing really well for a lot of years now. I don't think you're going to see Twilio grow like this for another 20 years, maybe 10 years, but not 20 years. And when you do the math on it, I think that's why valuations are so rich, is because sometimes you can expect it to grow 20, 30 years. And if you can keep those rates for 20, 30 years, the companies become massive and very profitable. And there's a lot of, you know.
No, that's absolutely. I mean, it's... so you talked about not knowing where these companies could end. And I guess, you know, you didn't know starting with Yext as well, because you started with you and the founders and you didn't expect that.
Yeah, it was like a 20-person team. We didn't know. But, you know, there's some amount of faith you have to have in this, as much as it's delusional, that like you can pull it off. Because if you don't, then you can't, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of like, you know, if the odds are 1%, let's say there's odds are 1% that you're going to do it. If you fully acknowledge it's a 1% chance of you doing, then it is a 0% chance. But if you acknowledge that it's like a 20% chance of it happening, then your 1% maybe creeps up to 2%. So like you have some control in this destiny. It is in this narrow bound, but you need to believe it is in a larger bound so that it is even at the top end of the narrow bound.
Yeah. You're basically, sort of paraphrasing the shoot for the moon and you'll end up in the stars or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely love that mindset, obviously, because I'm an entrepreneur myself and all that. But I mean, it would have, I mean, it's not very usual that I meet a marketer that started, you know, as a first hire and, you know, now the company is, and you've been with the company for a while, and the company is now traded. How did that journey happen? Like, tell me about like the milestones and getting bigger and bigger.
I'll talk about that. So like we started from the bottom. Now we're here, kind of, you know. But no, we started like small office. Like there was a mile set that were running around in it. It was funny enough. It was like in Columbus Circle above this Indian restaurant, and we were with Buddy Media. Was the other office in the building. They actually sold the Salesforce for like $1 billion or 800, some lots of money. So it was like two tech companies in this really old building with mice that went on to be like pretty impressive, you know, as stories, at least out of New York. And so we started as an ads business, as a pay-per-call business around phone, like selling phone calls to local businesses. So if you're a veterinarian, you would sign up. We would run ads with tracked phone numbers. And if you got calls and you booked appointments from the numbers that we sent, you would make some money on it. I mean, we would charge you some money on it, but only if you made money. And so it was this kind of pay for performance, past the click, past the impression, to this phone call, to this booked appointment is the model. So So that we started with, like, when I got there, there was like four or five verticals. We built it up to like 40. But the challenge was that we did a lot of research. And so the VC thesis was that, like, oh, it's very profitable in vets, very good in vets. And vets is like, you know, one business. If you do 40 times, then it would be 40 times that business. And you could be, you know, multiple billion of revenue. Or if it's 100 or 200 industries. But, like, that logic was flawed because we picked the most lucrative businesses. The incremental ones you were going into were like worse than the ones you're currently in, less likely success. And every business had its own unit economics, every vertical. So like vets, we might be able to drive a phone call for cheap and sell it for good. And all the economics worked for like, we could make money and the vet could make money. But then you went down the path, like podiatrists, for example, was like very good in terms of, dermatologists was very, we could drive calls very cheaply. We could drive a quality phone call for $4 or $5. And so we were expecting to sell it for like $40-$50. But the reason we could drive it so cheaply was because dermatologists are so full. They don't have need for marketing products. So none of them were interested in buying this product because they were like, I don't need to pay $40. I don't need to pay $20. I don't need to pay anything. I don't need to do marketing. People are dying to come to me. I'm full. And so there was a mismatch there. And then we saw the other things were like HVAC. We're willing to pay $50, $100, $200 a call. We could sign them up all
what
day.
What is HVAC? I'm sorry.
Oh, heating and cooling in homes and like buildings and offices.
Okay. All right.
Heating, ventilation, air conditioning.
Okay. Yeah.
We could drive calls they could pay $50, $100, $200. They were like, yeah, you give me, if you're calling me for jobs, if you can send me jobs, I can pay you whatever, you know? We couldn't drive them any jobs because it's hard. That's why they're willing to pay so much money. And so, and then the retention was different across all the thing. There was like, it was a nightmare to scale that business. Yeah. So that business kind of got from 0 million revenue to like 20 million of revenue. And we raised at a big fat valuation, 125 or something. We went from 25 to 125 in a year. Again, these all sound quaint in today's world, but at the time in 2009, it was very impressive. We were outside of Twitter. We were the fastest growing kind of on a multiple basis that in that time frame, in that year, you know, we were hot and we grew fast, but then we plateaued because it was fucking impossible to scale that business. So then the business plateaued. We pivoted to this other business listings thing that was like tangentially related, but like more scalable. And you didn't have to learn about all the industries and you didn't have a variable bill for the customer each month. And it wasn't as complicated to explain. And there weren't all these like individual unit economics. And you could scale to big companies. You could scale to partner channels. You could do all this other like stuff that was really good. So we spun off the old business, sold to ISC. And then we had to run it back again from zero. So like 2011, you're starting again at zero with the new business and you run it back to 100, right? So you kind of learn something the first time, but also the second time, you had your whole stack of engineers, you had your whole marketers, you had all these resources the second time around that you didn't have the first time around. And so like, I felt like we executed a lot better. Basically you got to do the whole thing over, but like, with like a bunch of stuff, you know, like if you have a video game and you picked up a bunch of items in the first level, but then you had to go back to the beginning, but then you get to keep your items, like you have a better chance of doing it the second time. And so there was a little bit of that, you know, but then also, like, we started really focused small business, and small business churn is high.
Yeah.
Like, because the businesses go out of business, it's hard to build the value. I think they scrutinize every line item down to, like, you know, $100 a year. They'll scrutinize really closely. Mm-hmm. And so we started there, but then eventually we got some enterprise steam. We got some partnership steam where other people were selling the product at a high scale. And so it went, like, where small business, when early years, when I was running small business marketing, kind of running small business P&L, I had, it was like 60, 70, 80% of the business, right? Early. And today I think it's like, I think the small business section does like 10 million on 400 million, some microscopic thing, you know, it was doing 10 million in 2013, it's doing 10 million now, you know? Yeah. So that was one of the things, is that the business pivoted the product, but also pivoted the go-to-market. And so between the combination of those things, we were able to get the business off the ground and really grow it. You know, there's always these ceilings though, right? So I think that there was a ceiling there. And I think that's why they're running into this problem now where it's like ceilings at 400 million. If you look, the old business, the first business ceiling was at 20, 25 million. The new business ceiling might be at $400 or $500 million, which is still good. Then you can build a decent business, you know. But also, I think it also, like, at some point, the founders and, you know, those people, like, their interest goes somewhere else, right? Because, like, grinding out like a slow growth 10-15% business is tough, right? If you're a high speed entrepreneur that wants to, like, run a business that's, like, constantly growing, it's tough to get to be interested in that slower growth business. And I think that maybe it's more suited for kind of a private equity. I think that's what you've seen a lot of private equities do really well, by taking founder-led companies out of the public markets, cleaner, getting the vision to be slightly less impressive in scope and more achievable, and then flipping them back to some other public company that they can plug into that machine, you know, kind of that Marketo story, you know?
Yeah, it's fascinating that the company had to sort of reboot, like, in the sort of the middle of the you know, the growth curve. And still put it off. It's amazing.
I think I think a lot of people would have just failed at that 2025, and they just would have packed up their bags and failed. Yeah. Or they would become these, like, zombie companies that, like, try to get to, like, cash flow positive, and they live on, and, like, no one is particularly impressed by them anymore, but they're reasonably self-sufficient and nobody wants to buy them except for some low thing, and maybe the CEO leaves, but, like, maybe they stay, and it just kind of goes on forever. And, like, you know what I'm talking about, you know, it is a thing.
And you had to, I mean, you were fresh out of college, so you basically learned everything about marketing there, and what a school to be in.
I thought so too. It was it was cool. It was really cool. I reported the CEO, Howard Lerman, who was, like, I felt like he's a marketing genius, right out of school. And it was a very, very cool thing. You know, now he's like, has like hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, and he's this hot shot with the jet and stuff. But, like, we were just, like, random little guys in a small room, you know, in our 20s. I think when I started, I was 22, he was 28, and it was still, he had somehow had like 10 years of experience running companies at 28 or something ridiculous, you know. So I learned a lot, and I really am lucky to have that experience.
It's you know, I think mentorship at that level, especially when you're in your 20s, and, you know, I mean, it's really great that you could find someone that motivated you to really, like, push yourself and could teach you so much. And that's really awesome. Do you still have that relationship with him, or is it still?
I mean, maybe less now than in, like, you know, 2008, 2009, but we still talk. You know, I think there's a close bond for us that pulled it off, that did it together, you know. But there's also another thing that I think about sometimes. I think in the moment I was like, you know, this is career defining. I think at some points you think career defining, but careers are long, right? Careers are 30 years, 40 years. And so I have opportunity to, I feel like, build another thing like this here, where I have a more senior role from the beginning. And you know, I don't think this is my last run at it. I can't imagine. And I think when you look at the numbers in isolation of, like, how many startups are successful and how many get started, it does look daunting. But, you know, there is something, winners keep winning, you know?
You get
a better look, right? I think the same thing when you look at, like, why are the best VCs always, not always, but why are the best VPs generally the best VCs? It's not because they're the smartest, but it's because they get the best looks. It's like, you know, I've had friends that work at VCs that are a little bit lower, like a little bit kind of lesser known. And if they give a company a term sheet, they're just going to go immediately shop it to all the big shops, and somebody's going to be like, oh yeah, I'm in, I'll take it. Yeah. And so, like, there is this amount of, So I feel like because I've been successful in the past, I'm going to have better looks in the future. I'm going to be a little better skilled at identifying what has chance or doesn't. And then also once I'm there, I think I'm more likely to stay if there's a chance of a good outcome. So like, there's like a lot of things in your favor. Once things are in your favor, things are in your favor more, right? So careers are long. I think I had a great run at Yext. It's super fun. I learned a lot, but I hope I learned just as much in BentoBox. I think I have. And I think I learned just as much in my next thing. I don't know where that is, you know, years down the road. I mean, I hope I can get, you know, 6, 7, 8 years BentoBox. That'd be wonderful. Then, and then get maybe have another run, but I don't know what I want. You know, I think at some point you're kind of doing it for the love of the game. I see some of my friends that have been a very successful outcome from Yext, and they're still working real grind and they're so rich. And I'm like, why do you do this? But I think that it is, there's a love of the game, you know?
Yeah. So what do you want to learn at BentoBox? Because it's another part of your career. You've sort of grown into more of a leadership role, and you have learned so much with Yext, and you want to sort of bring this to BentoBox. So what is it you want to learn? What is it you want to grow?
Yeah. I think there is something different in, I think Yext was like it's a go-to-market business first. So everything is formulated like, what can we sell? And then who will buy this and how do we sell it and all that stuff. And I think that BentoBox is very much like a product-led company first, in that like, what problem are we solving for restaurants? Like, can we really improve their business, and how do we take their business to the next level and then attach our go-to-market to that? And I think that is a different strategy than I've ever experienced at Yext. And I think that there's value in this difference, and I want to, so I think that having successful experiences in different styles of running a business is valuable, and is also intellectually interesting that like there is not one way to scale a business. And I think that that is something that gets lost in all of the like growth hacking, like reading about successful companies, is that like, yeah, you want to emulate from the best, but like you need to find what is your strengths. And I think this about management too, is that like, mentorship is that like, I think sometimes there's a big focus on like working on your weaknesses, improving them, especially ones that are like very bad. So you're like, oh, I need to fix these things, which is important. I don't want to take it away. But so much of like self-improvement goes around that. But it's also like sometimes you're good at something and you can be better. You can be the best at it, you know? And if you look at like the best basketball player, and it's like, they're working on basketball. They could do some cross training. They're working on basketball all the time. They're working to become a basketball player, you know? Or like great shooters might shoot more. They might not be like, oh, I'm a great shooter now, let's work on other stuff. They might be like, how can I be like the best shooter of all time? And I think sometimes in business or in personal growth, like we don't take that same approach of like, we focus on things we're not good at and try to fix them. And those might have lower leverage because you might be so bad and maybe a little better, but like the leverage is low. Where if you're really great at something and you can become better at it, the leverage could be high. And so, I feel the same way with a business, with you, you're running a business. How do you focus on your strengths? How do you make them stronger? How do you make your business strength stronger?
Absolutely. And especially as a manager, I think it's even more important to know how to identify those strengths and those skills within your team, and identify the weaknesses as well. And sort of bringing playing with what you have, and you know, making people work on what they're good at, etc. And I feel like this is this is something that is not easy to learn. You know what? Like it takes a long time, especially for marketers, where we are always focused on, you know, brand awareness, lead generation, revenue, etc., etc. Being a good manager is something that is completely new for a lot of marketers that step into the role, you know, the moment they step into the role. And so, you know, how did you yourself sort of learn this? Did you go to, do you have resources that you checked out? Did you count on, you know, mentorship? Did you just go and did you wing it? And how did it happen?
Yeah. Well, I think there is a few things to unpack. Yeah. I started like my first time managing, I was like, pretty new. You know, I think it happens the same way a lot of people, it happens where your boss gets let go and there's a team and somebody has to run that team and yeah. you now. And so I've had that experience that happening. And at the time I learned from my mentor, Howard, but I felt like his skills weren't necessarily in management. And one thing I jokingly call it Howard Lerman School of Management is that you focus on your best people. And you focus on your best people and you really bring the best out of them. And then you focus less on your not as great people. And so I think that I have taken that school of thought, that management kind of a lot. And I've moved to that. But I think now I would really like to course correct a little bit and focus, being able to focus on everybody and be able to bring the best out of everybody. And because sometimes people need a little bit more and they have a lot of potential and you just haven't addressed some things that are maybe easier hurdles to get more potential, you know, help people yeah. achieve their potential. I think really it's about like focusing, but because of this, like where I came from, I still believe in this, like really, you know, focus on your strengths because also that makes you happy. I think working on your weaknesses all the time makes yeah. you really good at them. I think there's some real achievements, but like, I think it's an yeah. opportunity to work on your strengths. I think that that's something that I like to remind people at work for me.
Yeah. Yeah. But on a just on a practical level, let's say someone has just jumped into a director role and it's the first time, you know, what would you practically advise them to do as sort of, you know, the way they run maybe meetings or the way they run one-to-ones with their team?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
what would
yeah.
you advise them to do?
Okay, so first of all, there's this company called Life Labs that I used it at old that came to an old company and they're coming here. And I think Life Labs is really great. And I think that every company should use some kind of management training because I think especially with startups, especially with high growth companies, a lot of experience managing people and also they're managing a ton of people and they like don't know how to do it. It's hard. And I think there's some value there. So I think that that's what's been really valuable for me. I think you have to find what is important for you to feel like you have an understanding of what's going on, because I think at least this is my own personal experience is that if I feel in the dark, then it's like it's hard for me to be a good manager. I feel like, or I, you know, make sure you have you trust your folks and find a way to get to the point where you can trust them. That's like really important. But yeah, and there's like something that I was thinking about with like kind of two things I like to look at for my team, two traits kind of agnostic to the position is intellectual curiosity. Like you are genuinely interested in like learning more about the business, about what the drivers are and how you can make an impact and like what your role, how it works with the business and try to like investigate things on your own. And then kind of troubleshooting skills, because like if you're growing fast, you're changing a lot of things, things go wrong, things go right and things go wrong. You have to figure out what they are. And being able to do that on your own is like really valuable. And you can teach someone this for sure.
Yeah.
There's be willingness to learn. There's be willingness to commit to this. And it kind of goes hand in hand, this intellectual curiosity and this troubleshooting skills. And I think those two, if you're a new manager, it really helps to have people with those experiences because you're not able to guide them all the time. Also, I think I think the managing in the COVID world is hard. I think I used to be kind of manager by osmosis. Coach by osmosis. I'd sit next to my team, and as I would come up with ideas or a thing would come up that I thought was interesting that everyone should know, I would stop and tell everybody, like, "Hey, this is the thing." And now I think you can't really do that as much because we all live in our own bubbles. So I've tried to like set up like little working sessions where you get in a Zoom and you work on, it's not updates, like you work on a problem. You pull up the Excel, you pull up like the AdWords or you pull up the Salesforce records and you like talk it through. Okay, what would I do in this case? What would you do in this case? Okay, where is the trouble? And then you get, it's pretty good.
Yeah, based on specific problems and not just have a sort of an open meeting, but really focus on a specific issue that you can solve together. And this is where good coaching can happen. Absolutely. It's been great chatting with you, and I want to just end we're almost done with the time. I saw that you were after Yext and the great job you've done there, you took some time to travel, and I saw that on your LinkedIn. Like, could you tell us more about that? I'm curious.
Yeah, man, that was kind of crazy. It was very much like backpack and passport. Like 2 weeks before I left for the trip, it was like 4 months long or 5 months long, whatever. And like 2 weeks before I left, I like had a one-way ticket to Sweden. And that was, oh no, to Norway. No, to Germany. Sorry. I had a one-way ticket to Germany. That's where I started. My memory is failing me. I had one way ticket to Germany, and that was like it. That's all I had. And then like with 2 weeks left, then I booked my next couple trips or something. And then I was just like on the road with a backpack and a passport, and I went from city to city. And it was kind of like a blistering pace. And so there was a little bit less vacation maybe than I would have thought originally, but it was, you know, self-directed. So it's like a blistering pace because I did it that way, you know? Yeah. And then it was like, you know, I think that, so there was something really great about seeing all these places and having all this, these experiences, the foods, the sights, the like, you know, riding a motorbike through Vietnam kind of thing. They were all fun. Yeah. But there's also like, just like being on you by yourself for that long, there's like a lot of introspection. I think you become a lot more, you can listen to yourself better. You can talk to yourself better. You can, you unlock something that I didn't think I had before. And I think that's been really useful. I think it helps me communicate with others because I can communicate better with myself.
That's that's an awesome insight because I think it's really, it can be said so transformational, the traveling, especially if you're traveling by yourself. And it's absolutely, I think it's something that every marketer, every leader anywhere should try and do, like, and most of them do. I mean, it's not like something most of, you know, marketers and leaders tend to, like, you know, travel more than the average, let's say, population. Yeah, but it's, I think it's a really cool experience you had there. And so, you know, it's been great chatting with you. Thank you so much. Do you have anywhere we can find you online if someone who wants to connect with you?
Yeah, you can come to my LinkedIn. Also, I have a newsletter that I write about stocks called Mo Money Mo Connie. That is, I've been writing for not about a year, but there's about one that comes out once a month. I had I did something on GameStop recently because everybody was doing GameStop, but mine was better than the average. I'll tell you. And then I had one on the federal debt and should you be worried about it. I had that, and then I had a really one I really liked a lot on Zoom. And so I think that if you're interested in reading more from me or hearing more from me, I think check out my newsletter. It's on Substack, Mo Money Mo Connie.
Awesome. Yeah, is it a paid newsletter?
Yeah, it's free. It's free. Just build in the audience, you know.
Okay.
I think I think if a good one gets 1,000 readers or something, if I can get some juice on it, but you know, just want to get. It's a fun intellectual exercise for me to write it, and so I'm awesome. Happy for people to read it for free.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll definitely put a link there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.